Our mission is a simple one. ERA 5050 want to see women represented on stage and screen in equal numbers to men.
Here, on the New ERA podcast, we will be talking to the women and men of the moment who are working towards equality, celebrating their success and discussing the solutions we can use to help move the industry forward.
Hello and welcome back. Thank you for joining us for this, the second episode of the New ERA podcast. I'm Ellie Yates.
And I'm Rose Riley. And this week we'll be sharing with you a little bit more about the founders of ERA 5050 and what they've achieved so far and how you can support the campaign. We'll also be hearing about a very exciting show that is transferring to Wilton's Music Hall this June.
But first we have a special interview with the actress Nicola Kavanagh, who is the inspiration for a huge bronze statue outside the Theatre Royal in Plymouth. We talked to her this week about how she got involved, the response to the statue, and what representation means to her.
We are here talking to actress Nicola Kavanagh to talk about how she came to be the inspiration for a 7 metre tall, 9 metre wide, and 9.5 tonne bronze sculpture called The Messenger that stands, or we should probably say crouches, outside the Theatre Royal Plymouth. The Messenger was commissioned by the Theatre Royal Plymouth and created by Cornish artist Joseph Hillier and is the biggest lost wax bronze sculpture in the UK. We actually first came across the story in an article in The Guardian back in March, Nikki had some really poignant and insightful things to say about female representation. And we thought it would just be a really interesting thing for us to talk about in terms of our work at ERA 5050 and our messaging. So here she is, the messenger herself. Hi, Nikki.
Hello.
Thanks so much for agreeing to just have a chat with us. You're in Dublin at the moment.
I am in Dublin, yeah. I'm currently sitting in my car where it's nice and quiet and the sun is out, so I'm delighted.
So I suppose just like jump straight in with how did you become to be the inspiration for The Messenger?
First of all, thank you so much for having me on. It's so nice to talk to you ladies. What you're doing is really important. How did I become the inspiration? So yeah, I was doing a job. I just graduated drama school, went to Bristol Vic. And I graduated, and the Frantic Assembly had always been a theatre company that I'd just been mad about, so I was so lucky to get my first job out of drama school with them. I couldn't believe it. You know, doing the job, very much engaged in that, but there was an artist commissioned to do a piece of art to be put outside the Theatre Royal Plymouth. So, I mean, to us, we were doing the play, we were very focused in on that, but Scott Graham, the director, gave him a couple of hours with us. And he kind of riffed off us. We were rehearsing and he kind of said, you know, stop, freeze there. And one of my poses was kind of me jumping off a wall. And I was kind of crouched down. In the play, it was ready to go, kind of ready to pounce at any moment.
What was the play you were doing and what was the part you were playing?
Yeah, so I was in a show called Othello. When I'm doing the pose, I'm very much, we were all kind of in a fight scene, so none of us were our characters. But for the overall play, I was playing Bianca.
So when did you find out they would be using your image for the statue?
So that was kind of like a gradual thing. I knew he was making pieces, but I didn't really know it would be. I knew he kind of liked my image because he had been emailing me a bit. I think maybe 2 years ago, but they had gone through a lot of back and forth with the council and the people of Plymouth and everything. So I think it was off the shelf there for a while. But then I found out properly, maybe around Christmas, maybe before Christmas. Yeah, because I was talking to Kirsty Oswald, who was playing Desdemona. I was sitting with her having dinner. And I was like, oh, God, I think they're going to pick my image. And I was like, oh, I'm not that into it. And she was just like, Nikki, this is amazing, like, for God's sake. And I was just like, oh, I'm just a bit shy, like, genuinely, like, not able for it. And also, you know, he did all the work, you know, mostly, you know, and Scott and all the people at Plymouth. So it was like, I was just a bit allergic. But then I really got on board with it. And like, I'm so happy I did because the response has been amazing. And it's been something like I'm incredibly proud of. But I kind of had to be shown the light a bit, you know. I kind of had to be shown how amazing it was and to have my voice heard as well. You know, I think as women, I don't know about you guys, but it's, I don't know, it's like we've almost been conditioned to not have a voice or something. And that's not for lack of brilliant role models or anything, but so, I mean, my initial reaction was that of like, oh, I just want to stay out of it. But no, I kind of grasped it, which I'm delighted I did.
So how did you feel when you actually saw it for the first time?
Wow, what did I feel when I first saw it? Well, I'd seen a little one of her. and I thought she was super cool. But when I first saw her, I guess I was quite overwhelmed because there was a lot going on, like press and stuff. But yeah, I was just like really proud to have been in the show and proud of Joseph, who'd done an incredible amount of work, and the people at Plymouth. Obviously, everyone who made her, like, she's massive. And the people who transported her, like, she's a beast. But also just, yeah, and like her, just her as her own entity, just proud of her.
And does she, I don't know, does she represent anything for you? What does she represent to you?
I guess she represents, it's weird, just this kind of feeling of, like, you know, it's very kind of emotional, actually. Like, kind of what I was saying about not having a voice, and like anybody, any little girl who feels like they don't have a voice, or little boy who doesn't feel like he has a voice, you know, because the patriarchy hurts little boys and little girls. And that, like, let's grab this, let's grab life and not worry and go for what you want.
Did you, like, on that kind of thread, was there any kind of criticism that you came across, or not that you came across, that the messenger came across? And what was that criticism, and what's your reaction, I suppose, to that criticism?
No, I didn't get any like personal criticism. And I was worried about that when, like, Joseph, I said to him, I'm happy for my name to be involved. And I was quite worried that maybe I would, because I'd seen some initial articles like the Daily Mail or something about like Radcliffe's revenge, and some guy saying it looks like she's doing a squat. And oh my God, I think somebody said, I don't know, maybe I imagined this, but I don't think I did. I think some guy said, we're going to erect a massive penis under her.
Oh,
so like,
God.
Yeah, I don't think I imagined that, because that seems like really far-fetched. No, I think I read that somewhere. Like, you know, she's squatting. It's so undignified for a woman to be squatting. I mean, look, to that, I just, that was a bit, when I kind of thought of putting my name forward, is because this, weirdos out there, like, we're lucky in that we have like a circle of brilliant kind of feminist left-wing people, but God, yeah, there's some crazies out there. So I was a little bit afraid. So she got loads of negative criticism about that stuff. You know, the most prevalent one, I think, or the most widespread one, was how undignified it was for a woman to be in that position. And you know, you have to, I guess the thing is, if we do want to make change, so easy just to be like, oh, for God's sakes. But I think we have to kind of realize that people who are saying that maybe are of an older generation and aren't used to change, and nobody likes change. And I guess the way to kind of, I guess it's just kind of a take them in and just be like, look, it's okay. This is just a new day now. It's a new era, and it's going to be fine. She's not sexually, you know, in a sexual position, even if she was, you know, it doesn't matter. But it's just the fact is that she's doing something, and we're not used to seeing women do stuff. Not in a lot of things. It's we're changing it, but like it's a big kind of complicated concept. And I guess how I deal with it is try to understand where they're coming from. But as I said, I didn't get any criticism personally. But I guess the whole thing comes down to change and how people are afraid of it.
It's quite amazing how radical it seems to people to have a statue of a woman in such an active, physically strong position. It's quite amazing that was shocking to people.
Mm. Yeah, it was. And, you know, I'm so glad because she's quite ambiguous. You know, you wouldn't really 100% know she was a woman. I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, but she feels kind of a little bit androgynous. And I'm so glad that Joseph made a point of being like, she's a woman, you know, this is a woman. And yeah, it's just that thing, isn't it, of change and people not being used to seeing women in such a strong position. And it's almost worse that she's in a strong position than it is demeaning sexually, you know. It's kind of like they'd rather her just be demeaning herself in a sexual way than than actually being just engaged in her own world, away from the male gaze, in her own bubble of, you know what I mean, like away from all that stuff.
It's interesting because most of the sculptures and statues that are in public spaces traditionally are either kind of classical nudes or are kind of damsels in distress or are, I suppose, iconic figures of these women who otherwise aren't as aren't portrayed as a symbol of strength that the messenger seems to be. Is she's
exactly.
And I feel like it's telling, and it's a shame that people's initial response was that of sexualizing it, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's a small number of people. I guess the thing is, though, I mean, I'm glad in a way because it makes people talk about her. The good thing about it is that it sparks debate. She sparks conversation with people around Britain and in Ireland as well. And I think that's incredible because, you know, that's what changes the world. Conversations little by little, and that's I think the female way maybe of doing it as well, is just kind of a little more gentle, a little gentler, and just let's be calm about this. And I really, yeah, I think that's really important to spark that debate and conversation. So yeah, I just hope that the messenger becomes kind of symbol of hope and change and good things, you know. Hope it's not going to be any bad. But then that's up to people, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, and I suppose on that note, like, how do you feel about... I mean, this statue is going to outlive you. Have you had any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, if I have grandkids, I'll be like, now Leia Rose, that Nikki's statue when she dies. what do I think? I think that's, you know, I think that's amazing. But I suppose it's not like, it's not me, it's she's herself. And
right.
I've had a small part to play in having a voice, which has been incredible. And it kind of, it's culminated in a lot of experience being from the country that I'm from, you know, and the abortion's finally legal here in Ireland, just as of last year. Yeah. I mean, we still have a long way to go in Northern Ireland. Mm. It's not legal at all. So there's still a lot going on, and obviously then there's people in the world trying to take our rights away from us constantly. So yeah, that's what I think she's... Hopefully she'll stand there proud and be a kind of a symbol of a better society, maybe in a small way. Yeah. That'll be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, and hopefully she'll stand in a time when we don't need to have, you know, organisations and campaigns and, you know, things to make society equal. That's
absolutely
the aim.
Yeah, I mean, just wouldn't that be brilliant? Wouldn't that be amazing for our daughters and our sons and our little nieces and nephews? Just what's the big deal? Like, that's a bit of equality. Like, why is it so difficult?
Yeah, we're like,
I think people are just afraid. They're afraid, always afraid, aren't they? You know, they're afraid that she'll come to life and like stamp out the bad men or something. You know, I had these dreams that she like picked up a bus of like horrible men and just like shook us, you know. Maybe they're afraid of that. That's not going to happen. Maybe they're afraid of it. And obviously some, I think that will always face kind of a backlash of people who don't want things to change.
Mm-hmm.
Always going to be, but it's constant. Like, things are evolving and changing, and the only thing I think you can be sure of in life is change. So I hope people get on board with all the amazing changes that are happening and going to happen.
So a massive thank you to Nikki, who was sat in her car in Dublin when we interviewed her. Yeah, it was just brilliant to get her thoughts on her experience. I mean, who becomes the inspiration
such for a crazy thing,
a statue? Yeah. So it was just fantastic to get her thoughts on that. So thanks so much, Nikki.
So last episode, we played you a short clip from our interview with the Era 5050 founders, Polly Kemp, Deirdre Mullins and Karin Painter. And it was such a brilliant interview, and they offered such great insight into the campaign that we wanted to share the rest of it with you now.
We have with us today Polly Kemp, who is one of the co-founders of Era 5050, along with Karin Painter, a founding committee member and our creative director, and founding committee member Deirdre Mullins. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Amazing.
Do you just want to introduce yourselves briefly so we can hear your voices?
I'm Polly. And I suppose alongside Lizzie, we were essentially the first two bodies on board, as it were. We sent the first messages out. Lizzie sent the first text out, and then I responded to that. And then me and her sent out an email to a wider group. Then I made a phone call to my very good friend, Karen, because we needed to build a website. That was how we got Karen on board. And I totally took advantage of my relationship with her, and she designed our website, designed our badge, and has from that point driven the sort of branding and creative side of our campaign, as well as doing a huge amount of typing and administration, and just basically being really important pillar in the work that we've done.
Without, if you bought a badge, it's probably Karen who sent it to you.
Exactly.
I made it.
But she's more than just somebody who sends out badges. She's very much somebody who has created our brand, our shopfront, as it were, and also been really, really an essential part of our strategy and how we've written it and how we've presented that to the outside world. So I think without Karen, it would probably still be me in the kitchen just getting really furious trying to work out how to use Squarebox or whatever it is.
And how did you how do you remember being accosted by Polly to join the campaign?
It was a phone call. I don't remember the whole content of it, but it was, we're going to do something about this, are you in? And I said, yes, I'm totally in. And then it went on from there. We had the conversation about what they needed in terms of I think you needed a logo first of all, didn't you?
Yeah, I can't remember what order. I know we needed a logo.
Yeah, I think
we
did the logo quite quickly, and then a website, and all the messages, all the communication messages that took months, 6 months, I think it was, to write.
And Dee, tell us.
I was dragged into this debacle. So the first meeting to kind of get this into a movement happened at Soho Theatre in November 2015, is that right?
Yeah, November, December. Yeah.
And so I was there in the basement of Soho alongside people like Denise Goff and Olivia Colman and, I don't know, about 80 actresses who were all sort of full of rage. Oh my God, it was amazing. It was an amazing kind of moment of expression. And for some women who'd been in the business for 40 years, 50 years, you know, they were telling their stories and expressing their frustration that they never maybe had really an opportunity to do in that sort of couple of hours. And you know, and I was on board. I was so inspired. I was so I had lots of rage myself to channel, and I was dragged in.
No, because I remember talking to you at the door, and then we looked down on this sort of this amazing group of actresses. Actually, they were just, I mean, you know, the range of actresses that were there, from young actresses to, you know, Felicity Montague, who's an actress with extraordinary sort of CV and writer, you know, so it was a really weighty bunch. And I remember sort of trying to grab people as they went out. I think we had a bucket to collect the money so that we could pay for it, and people were bunging in money. And I remember talking to you at the door, and you know, there were people that you knew from the get-go that were going to do something. So lots of people want to help, and for lots of various reasons they can't always help in the way that is really consistently useful. And then there are people that you're like, oh my God, you are so going to be important and useful. And Dee was definitely one of those. You know, she's without Dee as well, I think, you know, we wouldn't have had some money for some of our activities. We wouldn't have had the amazing presentations that we've had without Dee. I mean, Dee's fantastic skill is to be able to take all the information that we've gathered and deliver it in a way that's funny and, you know,
impossible to refuse.
Yeah. So, you know, Dee is like the acceptable face of fury. I'm the slightly less acceptable face of fury. I'm just the slightly grumpy one with a pair of glasses and a fringe that's covering my eyes, you know. Whereas I think what's happened with ERA, actually, it's an organisation, how we've evolved is that we managed to have attracted women, including yourselves, with different skills, who are beginning to, certainly at this point in our development, really pad out areas of our strategy and our policy moving forward. And, you know, actually, there are women who've come with us the whole way. And that's really incredible. It's incredible that as an organisation, what we're also able to do is to give actresses who perhaps find their careers frustrating and annoying a chance to do something which feels like you've got agency and that you're achieving something, and that's great. Mm.
So for the people who don't know or who aren't sure, what is ERA 50/50?
Well, it's the equal representation for actresses. I think we started from a position of numbers, just more women on stage, on screen, because the research that we had read and the research that we did showed that there were two men for every one woman.
And on children's television, that's more like three male characters for every one female character. So that's pretty devastating for our young people growing up.
And given that the population is, you know, by a percentage point, predominantly female, that seems wrong. So, I mean, it was something that we felt, you know, as your, you know, careers begin to dwindle, so you begin to experience it. So, you know, we knew experientially that there was less work for us.
It's really good to know this fact that I don't think I knew until I really got involved in the campaign, which is that, you know, men and women have sort of equalish amounts of work in their sort of 20s and 30s are pretty good too. But then once you move up to 42 to 65, then you're looking at women have about one-fifth the amount of words that men have, equivalent dialogue. So that tells you that even the statistic that there are two men on screen to every one woman, really what you're seeing in the detail of that is that it's young women are on screen, whereas old women are hardly on screen, or you know, in inverted commas.
Yeah, and I probably actually an awful lot of those younger women are less so maybe right now, but because the conversation is moving a lot more strong lead female characters. However, sort of until the very recent past, those lead women would definitely be a sidekick, an adjunct, a victim. It wouldn't necessarily be a part that you could say this person really has real agency.
Absolutely.
You know, so for us it is, you know, it is qualitative, it's quantitative and qualitative. That's
so you don't want equal numbers of women on screen if they're not saying or doing anything.
Right. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, so to go back to that point, we started off with just the numbers, did some research, found some facts, and then what happens as you develop as a campaign is you start to begin to look at root cause. So I'd say actually, as a campaign, we also know that unless we have gender equality at sort of key creative roles, you know, so that's commissioners, producers, that's definitely writers and definitely directors, you're not going to see the kind of representation of women on screen in numbers with agency that we see as true equality. So as a campaign, we campaign for the equal representation of actresses. However, we work in coalition with other campaign groups that are looking at other areas of equality within our industry, above and below the line. So, you know, we champion Directors UK, we champion the Writers Guild,
Act for Change,
PIPA, yep. You know, all of these organisations are part of a movement that support and help us to achieve true gender equality.
Mm. Absolutely. There's some beautiful little stats on that. Like there was 105% increase of young women taking up archery after the Hunger Games was on in the US. Mm-hmm. That's incredible. 105% increase. Or the UCAS application system had 17% increase in women applying to be midwives because Call the Midwife was on and it was having this big impact on young people. So like it just shows that one television show can literally change the course of your life.
Yeah.
It's powerful, incredibly powerful. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and at that event that you're talking about that we held at BAFTA last year for over 150 industry leaders, we had Lucy from the BFI who did a presentation from the BFI filmography, which is very interesting. It's online. I think you can find it under BFI filmography. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the occupations, so they studied a sort of a whole bunch of films, and if you look at the occupations, that the predominant occupations of women, I think you find whore, mother, victim, or, you know, titles like that. So there's plenty of data and evidence to back up the fact that there isn't equality, in spite of being called out by a radio interviewer once telling me, come on, Polly, there's loads of women. There's a female prime minister.
Yeah. What else do you need?
And Keely Hawes is starring in The Bodyguard. I mean, really, what do you want about?
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a bit more about this event in BAFTA in February last year?
I think it came about because we decided that all the actors and actresses knew there was an issue, but we wanted to get the statistics to the people, the decision makers who make the films and produce all the things we see on television. So we decided it needed to be somewhere high profile with high profile people attending, and to get all the statistics down into one event and present it to them all.
Mm-hmm. And solutions.
And solutions. So, with solutions, yeah, with our idea for our
campaign solution. It's a positive way forward. We don't, you know, it's not about shaming or people, it's about looking for ways we can fix this and fast.
Yeah.
So that the event had always been, I think the thing that Lizzie and I had talked about very early on was what we wanted to do was take this to Parliament, mm-hmm. and have an event for the gatekeepers. Those were the two sort of key objectives we set ourselves. And we'd already had some meetings with Maria Miller in Parliament, and we'd talked to Jess Phillips and we'd talked to Tracy Brabin. So that was the next on the list of things we have to do. I have to say that I am terrified generally the whole of my life. I'm just terrified about everything. And I and the BAFTA event terrified
me. It's not true.
The BAFTA event terrified me more than anything.
Yeah.
Not because I didn't feel that we weren't capable of meeting. It wasn't really about the people coming. It was about the fact that we're a voluntary organisation. Mm, yeah. We raise the cash through, you know, hard-fought lady fueled hours of women just beavering about running around London. We raised £16,000 through donations. Not one person got paid, and we spent all that money on an event. And I felt a huge responsibility that every single penny of that, because it came from donations of people buying badges, and it came from major sponsors like Spotlight and Equity gave us some money, and you know, wine companies, Avery's gave us some discounted wine. You know, so there was a lot of work done to create that, and I wanted to make sure that, I don't know why personally I felt it was really important that we made as much of an impact as possible.
Sure.
And almost did have a complete nervous breakdown when the snow started.
Oh,
it was
in the afternoon,
do you remember?
Mark Kermode came all the way from Southampton to be there through the snow.
Amazing.
I mean, we had some amazing people there.
We really
did. I think we raised the bulk of the money in 10 days because I remember sitting in BAFTA and I signed the form by myself.
Don't tell me that.
And I said, what happens now? And she said, you just pay us this money in 10 days. Oh, right.
Sure.
But we sent out an email to all the people on our database. We had about 700 to 900 people on our database and said, we need you, just give us £10.
There were lots of people who gave £2, £5.
And some people gave £10, some people gave a lot more. And we raised it all within 10 days.
And it had
what we needed within 10 days.
Well. So people like Saskia Schuster, who's the head of comedy at ITV, has subsequent to this event, inspired by this event, created a 50-50 comedy initiative at ITV, which is all about networking between female writers and producers. It's about creating a database that these producers can access if they're like, oh, I do want to employ women. Okay, where do I go? Where do I find them? Which is a constant thing that we hear, a problem we hear. So you know, there is very palpable progress as a result of this.
And it's adding to the solutions, right? Which was the big message of the event was finding solutions for when someone says, oh, well, we don't know where the female writers are. Well, this has been set up in lieu of the event to say, well, here's a whole database of hundreds and thousands of writers for you.
Brilliant women writers. Mm. Yeah, I think so. I think in terms of value for money, I think we got value for money. I think anybody who donated, thank you very much indeed.
I think we
can say that as a result of that event, we've been in the room with some really, you know, we've been in the room with the commissioners from ITV, from Channel 4, from Sky. You know, we continue to have conversations at a very high level because we presented ourselves as a credible organisation. People took us seriously. You know, we gave them hard facts in a digestible form, presented with incredible charm. There's Deirdre Mullen to my right. And I think that what we're very good at is presenting the case in a way that those that we need to influence don't feel attacked, because I like to believe that it isn't about a malevolent desire to torpedo the careers of women. I don't think that's what it is, but I do think there is a disconnect between, you know, the belief that you know, there just aren't enough women out there. And the fact that there are, there are loads of women. So it's basically about, connecting people, really. It's going, hey, you, commissioner over there, actually there's loads of women over here, and let's just...
Well, and it's also about waking them up, getting them woke.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing more powerful than popping along to the old RSC and going, babes, here's your numbers. Mm-hmm. There's like 10 women and 500 men, you know, let's sort this out. Or popping into the National, you know, and mm-hmm. absolute hats off to these people. You know, when you present them with their numbers, they go, oh, yeah, okay, we'll do something about this, you know, mm-hmm. and that's glorious to see. And that's the best part of this campaign, is watching people change their mind and suddenly realise what they're doing. Because the truth is that we've all got unconscious bias. And that's what we're really fighting, is just people who haven't really thought about it before. Mm-hmm. They haven't thought about the fact that, oh, yeah, oh, when I write, 90% of what I write is male-led or whatever, you know. It's mm-hmm. just about a question of just kind of shaking them up a bit and going, come on, think a little bit harder. And you get incredible results very quickly.
And empowering them, so telling the people yes. in that room that they have the power to change it. I think Miles Jupp said something when he was chair of the, the news quiz?
He's the host of the news quiz.
He just made a decision that it would be
Yeah, he took
balanced.
Over from Sandy Toksvig, and they said, do you want to do anything different on the show? And he was like, you know what? I'd like equal number female panellists and male panellists. Mm-hmm. And they were like, okay. And so he just, over the year, not like each individual show, he wasn't like, you know, religious about it. He sometimes have three men and one woman, or three women and one man, but over the course of the year he would have equal numbers. And that's what we're looking at, is equality over a season, over a period of time, rather than each individual TV show or episode.
Yeah. I think that's a really important point, is that we know that it's impossible to, you know, to enforce people to do 50-50 on every piece of theatre, TV,
and why would you want to?
Do.
Yeah,
I
don't
want.
Awful.
No, but you just—it's to look at your yearly output, perhaps, and look at your numbers, and think about that, and think about ways of bringing in more female talent, because, you know, there are pipeline issues and sustainability issues with female careers. You know, there is this weird idea that there aren't enough women out there that I come across time and time again. And yet at film schools and the Writers Guild and drama schools, we know that at point of entry there are greater numbers, but then as they progress through their careers they seem to drift off down to this, you know, phenomenon.
Stop being employed. let's just call it what it is.
Or, you know, the unconscious bias or other obstacles pull us out of the workforce.
Am I right in saying that all the data that we presented at BAFTA already existed, but it had never been pulled together in one event and presented from the perspective of the actresses and the industry? That was what was compelling for me,
effects. That is true, because I think people often come at it, so you'll get writers, somebody presenting information about writers, somebody presenting information about directors.
Yeah.
And I think because of this root cause analysis that we had made, which is that without solving those two bits of the jigsaw, you're not going to solve on stage. I think that was quite extremely compelling for us.
Yeah. And presenting all those solutions, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, like for example, if you've already got a script, it's been put into production, you know, you're about to go and film. What you can just have a look at is all your neutral parts in that script. So, for example, the lawyer they go and see, the policeman, the politician. Just because the writer's written it doesn't necessarily affect the story if you just go, okay, well, maybe that politician can be a she, or that police officer, she. Mm-hmm. So, like, there's ways of just really simple little ways of affecting change instantly, even if you're sort of looking at bigger root causes and looking at developing female writers, for example, for a season in a couple of years' time.
And immediately there are, you know, for instance, flipping the gender of the characters further down the cast list, you know, immediately addresses your gender balance. Obviously, what we'd be looking at in the future, though, is something much more sustainable. So it would be looking at a type of story. But yeah, so we presented solutions that you could, you know, affect change immediately, and then we were looking at solutions which were much more long term,
systemic.
And that exactly, and address the sort of systemic issues.
Yeah. Including, for example, I think things that people don't often think about, and in fact something that I was inspired by the Irish movement.
Waking the Feminists.
Waking the Feminists, exactly. Many of their solutions were around the DNA of the building, so the board. So this is something that, you know, even agents and casting directors and drama schools can start thinking about is, you know, is your board full of a bunch of white men
over a certain age
from a particular, you know, social background or whatever, you know, maybe that needs to be, when a place comes up, you can maybe look for a woman to fill that spot, so you can look for equality, you know, through the body of the building, because that you know, statistically is shown in research to create a much more dynamic and successful leadership team.
There's a huge bank of solutions, I think, that came out of the launch. What is next for ERA in terms of what you're targeting?
So we have a number of projects that we're developing. I think top of our agenda is funding. I think that we as an organisation have basically operated voluntarily and on the fumes of the small amount of money that's been donated to us. And I think that if we had a little bit more money, you know, we could work a little bit more consistently, because currently it's sometimes not consistent. Mm-hmm. So that's a big area that we need to work on. Having been all over it for such a long time, for me, it's been quite a difficult effort to sort of take my fingers off everything. And I'm really keen going forward that there are devolved, separate little groups of people doing work. Mm-hmm. So there's yourself.
SWAT teams. Mm-hmm.
SWAT teams. Yeah. So there's yourselves. You're doing this great. We're going to have this wonderful series of podcasts. So that's amazing. And we've got an actress currently who's hopefully going to organise a team of actresses to work on the theatre approach to theatres, because one of our objectives is to get... 20 is a number we've plucked out of the air currently, to sign up to our objectives and maybe put our logo on their website.
And to kind of create an industry kite mark. That's a really, I think, exciting. Karen, you're kind of...
Yeah. When we developed the logo at the beginning, it was developed as a sort of stamp, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that
was the idea, yeah.
So that has kind of come through, and we haven't used it to that degree yet, but I think ultimately we're starting to get inquiries from people who'd like to use it as a sort of stamp to show that there's
the
gender
badge.
Balance. Yeah, the
as
badge.
The stamp, yeah.
As a digital stamp on flyers to show that they're aiming for, or they've got gender balanced casting. So that's something we're definitely looking into now.
And on my particular horizon, I want to get in the room with the controllers of all the different channels and get some very firm commitments from them. So timelines, so we will do this by, and these are the numbers. You know, ideally we would like them to monitor their own content. Mm-hmm. So that's my, I'm totally fascinated by that. But Dee?
Well, just to add, I mean, Polly is looking at a policy and in discussions with the Arts Council. We've been in to see, you know, Kevin Brannan when talking about Brexit. One of the things that Brexit brings is the opportunity for change and an opportunity to really vigorously re-examine your cultural policies and their implementation, which is something that, you know, Polly is kind of works in that area. So she talks with the Arts Council a lot and, you know, other sort of stakeholder organisations. So I think she's undersold herself there a little. but, you know, all of that is sort of an area that you...
You know, I find that fascinating. I just, for me, it's always really simple. I just look at something and I just think, well, you just change policy, surely it's that easy.
Yeah, or enforce policy as well. Because a lot of, and what we find is a lot of theatres have, for example, mission statements where they're like, equality is one of our main drivers. And you're like, well, these are your numbers. So I'm not seeing that in action. So it's a question of, you know, making people perhaps work a little harder for their taxpayers' money if they're not actually representing the taxpayer.
Essentially, if a company or a building is receiving public money, then what we're saying is, well, your numbers should be equal across your season.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Because you're receiving as much money off your men as you are off your women.
Yeah. So, equally funded.
If you're receiving public monies as part of the criteria, the qualifying criteria for that money, you should be reflecting society as a whole in the content that you produce. So, you know, it should be reflective of, you know, of your sort of target audience. I mean, there are so many different, you know, there's BAME percentages, there's people with disability, you know, amounts as LGBTQ. Everybody, you know, everybody needs to be represented. I would say that gender, for me, if we start with gender equality first, I think then you can represent these other groups really fully.
Mm. Which is a problem that we come across often, is that, you know, theatres or where producers say, oh, well, you know, we've got lots of black men in it. You think the diversity is not the same as equality. And then they shouldn't have to fight for the pie. Often people think of diversity as a tick. They've ticked the box, and they don't need to think about the content of the.
Well, diversity covers everything. Mm. You know, it covers ageism, it covers gender, it covers LGBTQ++, it covers disability, and it doesn't. It covers one aspect of it.
So, what are you most proud that you have achieved so far since the first meeting in 2015? What's the individually,
we survived.
Yeah, we're alive.
We're still friends.
We're still friends. Yeah. I think. Well, there's lots of different things, but I think that we've created this positive movement that doesn't look like it's going to go away, and it feels to me like people do feel like they can get on board with it and do stuff and use us as a sort of platform.
We've empowered people.
Empowering people, yes, that's
much
better.
And open discussion, yeah. which allows people to talk about it, because, you know, before this happened, you sounded like a whinger and work whinging actress who just isn't good enough to get a job, rather than statistically the industry is against you, you know.
Yeah, and keeping it really, really positive. And like you said earlier about, it's not about shutting out men or, you know, being anti anybody. It's about, let's see how creative we can be if we're truly equal. And I see this movement going across lots of different, you know, in my industry, in jewellery industry, I think it's already having an impact there in the design industry. I think it could go quite far.
I mean, I'm proud of a lot of things. You know, sometimes I get incredibly teary when I see us all doing stuff. I find it extraordinary that, you know, that we didn't cover the fact that we're doing this piece of research. You know, the fact that that Dee and Emily are basically spearheading a whole research project that we're doing. But I think I'm most proud when people I don't even know name check our campaign in a tweet or on telly, or, you know, when I just hear Era sort of being name checked alongside some really leading big campaigns. When I hear that, I know that we are credible. And that the hard work that all of you, us, we have put into it has made an impact in terms of how we think about the arts. And to me, that's extraordinary. That came out of one text. Mm. One text.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think it's really important as well to stress that it's still very much, in the same sense as it was in 2015, a grassroots organisation.
Yeah.
And I think people see the branding and they see this incredible group of people, women and men, supporting this cause, and expect it to have a block of offices and, you know, 50 staff members and, you know, everyone that I talk to. I think it's really important to stress the grassroots nature of it, and you know, that's where hopefully some funding.
You know, I just met a couple of women who are starting up a campaign about women and age, and at the end we were just sort of winding up the conversation, and one of them said, "Oh, I feel really hopeful." She said, "Because often I meet organisations and they have huge amount of funding, and I just feel it's never going to be achievable for us." And listening to Ira's story, I realise how you just put one foot in front of the other and you just kept on going. And it isn't just me, it's all of us. We all kept on going. We just put one little Doc Martin foot in front of them. You know, we just kept on going. You know, I can't stress enough that the fact that people do this for nothing. Just so you know, out there in podcast land, this is done for very little. So, you know,
yeah, strong wins are things like the National Theatre, which I consider the jewel of the crown in theatre land. We're obviously recording it here, but you know, the fact that they have committed to it and committed to it publicly on their website, and they're going to monitor it, is is, I think it's like a dominoes. You know, if they do it, kind of they've embarrassed everyone else into doing it, and you know, quite right too. And I I'm just looking forward to seeing all those dominoes fall over the next year. And similarly, you know, I think that the same is happening in films and TV. Certainly BFI, their funding criteria is certainly radically shifted to be much more inclusive, and that's really, really exciting to see. So all sorts of areas you're seeing these changes all the time. And I would stress also, if anyone's listening and kind of thinking, oh, maybe I'll think about getting involved, I would say that, you know, one of the great rewards of this campaign is a personal reward, not only in that you're hanging out with some amazing birds and guys too. Big shout out to people like Tom Bevan, who runs our social media campaign. We've had some amazing men as well involved in this campaign, and that is one big point to really get home, is that this is something that's impacting all of our children and all of society. So you know, it's just as important for men to get on board this campaign as women, and we are so would love men to get on board and come in and sort of be doing the active kind of work within the organization. Yeah,
so practically, how can people
practically buy a badge, because that you can donate £2 to the organisation,
and tweet it, take a picture of it and Insta it and tweet it.
Yeah, so that's exactly, so you know, and wear your badge when you go to rehearsals or you go to your meetings
or to the theatre,
just wear your badge.
It starts conversations.
By three,
we respond to emails as much as we possibly can. Sometimes it can fall through the cracks, but do not be in any way discouraged. What I like is people who basically push to the front, stick their hands up and say, I will do some emails for you, or I will deliver badges around London for you, or I will come to your meetings and I will jump on board with the theatre initiative. So if you do want to be involved, just let us know and come along. We are completely open to all.
You know, if you're into research, so for example, Powerplay have come on board to help us with this massive research project. So they've got statisticians galore and all the rest. So you know, any area that particularly interests you, if it's making content, making podcasts, making videos, making sketches, you know, if you want to go and do talks at drama schools, there's all sorts of opportunities to get involved with a little bit of time or a lot. So we'd love to hear from
you. If you've got a legal background, I'd be particularly interested right now.
And I assume, you know, even though we're based in London, it's we're really looking to I suppose be involved with people across the UK.
I think it is really important for
crucial
us to do
that.
Mm-hmm. There is an actress in Glasgow or Edinburgh, I think, is very interested in starting a chapter there. So great. You know, but starting the chapters around the country, which I'd quite like to do. Mm-hmm. Is a piece of work in itself. Mm. And so, you know, that would be great to have people from various parts of the UK who want to initiate that. That would be really brilliant. Please feel free to approach us, because, yeah, we don't want to be southeastern based, sort of that slightly elitist world that, you know, that the perception can be for the arts.
So what's that email again, just in case people want to get in contact?
info@era5050.co.uk.
And can I also give a massive shout out right now to Act for Change, who have been kind of, in some ways, our parent kind of organisation, in that we have kind of flown underneath their wings, and certainly initially watching their incredible progress, both in their parliamentary talks and roundtables with Lenny Henry, and you know, all the work they do across the field. It's been utterly inspirational, and we have a lot to thank them for.
Yeah, they were very helpful at the beginning. They came and talked to us, and you know, yeah, so definitely we followed in there.
We fly in
their slipstream.
And in tandem with them, you know, we
under their wings.
Under the wings. Wow, beautiful.
In their footsteps.
Beautiful.
Bird metaphors.
Bird images.
Thanks again to Polly, Deirdre and Karin for coming in and talking all things ERA 5050 to us. We hope it gave you some more information about the campaign, where we're coming from, and hopefully where we're going.
Okay, so every episode we want to champion work that promotes women's stories and 50-50 casting and creative teams.
So back in October of last year, it did take us a little while to get this podcast up and running, we went to see The Sweet Science of Bruising, written by Joy Wilkinson and directed by Kirsty Patrick Ward at the Southwark Playhouse, where we recorded the audience responses to the show and its themes.
Here's what they had to say.
I just really wanted to sort of like know more about women that just like broke the boundaries, because we know big names, but we don't know the smaller names.
For people 10 years younger than me, for a teenager coming to see that on the stage, that would have been revolutionary for me when I was like 15 or 16. Like, I really hope women of that age can come and see this, because I think they should, to see women being strong and fighting for their lives in some respects.
These plays are so rare. And we need to be seeing them all the time.
It's such an important thing that these stories are finally being told.
This was really, really totally enthralling and of the zeitgeist at the moment in terms of lots of issues that are current, presented, you know, incredibly well.
Your gender isn't a definition of you. It's not the only thing that defines you, that it's a part of you, an element or a facet of you.
And you know, you just think, this play should be on the National, there should be more plays like this on the National, a play with four female protagonists. Why is it so, come along so rarely? Why isn't Joy writing for bigger theatres, you know?
You know, one of the things that we're campaigning for particularly is to get a much better representation of women. There's a huge gap in terms of seniority. And it comes from largely changing attitudes. And, you know, that clearly was an underlying theme throughout this play this evening.
I think especially in a genre that is very male-forward, like boxing, to see female leads in traditionally male roles is fascinating.
What I really loved about all of them was that they were three-dimensional. They weren't just one thing. They weren't the strong fighter, they weren't the woman being put down. They were all fighting against that, and they are able to be shown as more than just a wife, or more than just a prostitute, or more than just a working class woman. I just love seeing that on stage. It's very inspiring, and it motivates you to try to go out there, not only to see more of that kind of theatre, but maybe like bring more of it to the stage in any way you can.
We should just be commissioning more women, and we should just be writing about more women characters, and anyone who says we shouldn't be doesn't know what they're talking about. It's just nonsense. And you know, you just have to be eternally vigilant and concentrate on doing that, because it's the only way we're going to get things like this on everywhere.
If you like the sound of the show and what our wonderful interviewees had to say about it, The Sweet Science of Bruising will be transferring to Wilton's Music Hall this summer from the 5th to the 29th of June. And we'll put a link to tickets in the episode notes.
And that is it from us for episode 2. Thanks again for joining us and for listening. We hope you will join us again in 2 weeks' time, when we will have another show recommendation and a whole host of wonderful guests.
Please do get in touch with us directly on podcast@era5050.co.uk if you have any questions or advice, or you just like to support the campaign in any way. Please do get in touch.
And if you've enjoyed the podcast, then please do tell your friends, your family, your colleagues, your employees, your dog, your neighbour, whoever you can tell, please tell them about the podcast, and rate and review if you've enjoyed it, please, as it will help other people find us.
Thank you to our producer, George Jennings, all of our guests, to Suzanne Dyken and Charlotte Bevan at the National Theatre, where we are sitting recording this podcast now, and to Spotlight for all of their continued support.
We will see you again in 2 weeks' time.